The growing use of large data sets and ML in the life sciences has created new demand for data technologies. Snowflake is a cloud-based data warehousing company that provides a platform for storing and analyzing large volumes of data. Harini Gopalakrishnan is the field CTO of life sciences at Snowflake. She joins the show to talk about data challenges and solutions in biotech. This episode of Software Engineering Daily is hosted by Sean Falconer. Check the show notes for more information on Sean's work and where to find him.
Harini, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sean. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, thanks so much for doing this. I'm glad we were able to make this happen.
Yeah, same here. Likewise.
So you are the field CTO of life sciences at Snowflake. So, you know, just to start off, what exactly is that job? Like, what does that consist of, being the field CTO in particular of life sciences?
It's an interesting role. So basically within the field CTO organization, there is an industry focus. So there are a lot of peers of mine that take care of different industries. The idea is that Snowflake is a regular technology platform. I'd like to say that it's like an engine, and then you've got to customize it for the car that you need to build. And in my case, it's life science. So the positioning that I do for my customers in pharma, small, medium, biotech, AI-powered companies is, what does Snowflake do in the context of life science? So it could be a use case-driven conversation where we map the native Snowflake features to a specific use case and how to leverage it. It could be, in most cases, a partner-led conversation where we have a joint partnership with another, say, lab informatics vendor or a clinical powered by vendor, and then we're going into pharma together. So it's a variety of different things. That's the cool thing about the role, is that you have the flexibility to define it, but you get to speak across small, medium, and the large pharmas, and then you also get to talk to partners and technology vendors. So you're kind of keeping yourself updated at the same time trying to connect that back to a use case and value prop for our customers.
Yeah, so a lot of the time you're working directly with a customer, or maybe with a customer through a partner, to sort of educate them on what is possible with Snowflake to help them, you know, solve a particular problem or something like that.
Yes, and we also work internally on building industry-facing solutions. For example, we have a lot of focus right now is around AI and generative AI, because Snowflake is kind of new to that realm of users compared to other players. So we build industry solutions internally with our extended group that's called Polaris. And then we are telling the story with the help of an actual tangible solution, like a protein folding or a clinical fine tuning. And then if a customer is then interested, they can choose to take it forward themselves. So yeah, it's either partner, internal solution building, or directly with the customer, telling them how to leverage it for a specific use case based on what we see with other customers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then what was your background before, you know, prior to having this role as the field CTO at Snowflake?
Oh, it's an interesting journey. So a long, long time ago, I was a bioinformatician. So I moved from tech to actually using tech for a business problem. Be honest, I didn't know anything about genomics or proteomics before my bioinformatics program. So I picked it up during my course, and it was the best experience for me because I learned a lot of biology actually in my master's, but also how technology was solving for it. Then I was heading up a small consulting practice for research informatics. So that gave me the exposure of how R&D is done across all the pharma. Pretty much the same pattern, same kind of vendors you come across. And what struck me even then is 15 years ago, even before cloud was very popular or widely adopted, there was a lot of innovation going into how people leveraged technology in solving research problems, like protein docking, or, you know, being able to model and simulate many different possibilities for your drug candidate generation. It was always ahead of the curve compared to, say, the other value chain. So I was doing that, learned a lot. Then I moved to the industry with Sanofi. I was building a technology platform for real-world evidence, a bit more later in the pharma value chain. Then a short stint at a CRO called Syneos, then at AWS in the healthcare life science practice, and now Snowflake. So you could say I've seen through consulting, tech products, and industry. So it's more of a 360 view at this point.
Yeah, you've basically done everything. You just need to found a company now and you've covered it.
Yeah. Hopefully that's my next step.
Yeah, good ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I want to talk a lot about sort of technology in the space, you know, how, you know, cloud and AI is impacted biotech and biosciences. But maybe to start off with, to kind of just set the context for some of the listeners that are maybe less familiar with this world, is, you know, prior to the cloud, you know, hard to imagine that world if you live in the world of, you know, Snowflake and other sort of public cloud tools and platforms. But what did the technology for areas like drug discovery even look like?
It's a good question. So when I started, and it's not going to give up my age, but at least 15, 20 years ago, most of the customers had these high-performance clusters. So one of the classic use cases I used to see when in discovery, when we walk into pharma was, personally, when I started off my journey after master's, was administering this cluster. It's just locked in a room. And every time people were running a protein folding study on these compute grids, and every time they wanted to scale, I remember having to go and physically replace a node or add an additional node so that we could have the compute power. But the language of choice back then was Perl. Now it's Python, but it was similar. We used a lot of MATLAB for, you know, machine learning, even back then, classification, regression kind of use cases. But the long story short is that a lot of the programs were Linux-based, Perl-driven, parallelized in these compute nodes. So people were already thinking about terabytes of storage because the first human genome was sequenced. A lot of people were doing sequence analysis. A lot of the in silico drug design, what we call that is in the pharma, was looking at how a drug and a protein would dock and creating new variations on the candidate, and doing that in millions of orders of magnitude was already happening with the help of these high-performance computing. And there are very niche software providers like Schrodinger, which is very popular in this world for computational chemistry, who had leapfrogged the ability to create these algorithms, right, and then deploy in a cluster in a parallelized environment. So people were tapping into that and being able to do the accelerated drug design. So if you were to ask me 15 years ago, the way pharma would look at drugs is they go from millions of compound screening to a few hundred thousand to a top 10 that would go into animal testing. So, but going from million to 100,000 already required a lot of computational power and algorithms that were happening in these clusters.
Yeah, I mean, I think in this space, you know, biologists have been dealing with massive amounts of data, you know, going back to the 90s, you know, with the Human Genome Project and the project and stuff like that. Like, the, they had the concept of big data long before anybody knew what, you know, big data was, essentially, because there's just a massive amount of information that exists in the life sciences and in biotech.
Totally, right? And there are two schools, right? One is the biology part of it, where the human genome was sequenced and that there would be a lot of sequence alignment, pairing one sequence with the other, being able to build these hierarchical phylogenetic trees, which shows how does a certain family of proteins relate to each other. Those already required a lot of computational power. That's in the comp bio spectrum. And then even the small molecule, a lot of these companies were doing this modeling, creating new variations of compounds, tweaking a property here or there, and then seeing how that would bind to a protein. So that was also happening. So yes, reams of big data before it was called big data. Mm-hmm. And the modality of data was, it was flat. It wasn't tabular. So there are specific sequence formats like FASTA or SMILE strings, which pretty much were considered flat file representations. And being able to process that at scale was what folks were doing in the R lab back then, research labs.
Let's face it, no one likes writing or maintaining documentation. But when you start a technical project or pick up a new task, missing information can cost you valuable time. Gitbook is a technical knowledge platform that fills that information gap, making it easy for your team to capture, maintain, and find information from a single source of truth. Here's a couple of examples. With GitSync, you can set up a two-way sync between your repo and Gitbook, so you can turn markdown files into awesome, user-friendly docs. And if you make a change in your codebase or a technical writer updates the docs in Gitbook, the edits sync between the two automatically. Or what about when you need to find something in your knowledge base? Forget about searching, just ask Gitbook AI. You'll get a neat summarized answer sourced directly from your docs. Those are just a few examples of what Gitbook can do, but it has plenty more tricks up its sleeve. So why not give it a try? Head to gitbook.com to find out more.
From a, like a technology perspective, who was solving some of these like technical challenges back then? Are there people with, you know, computer science degrees that are being tapped to solve some of these like scalability challenges? Or is it people who have, you know, the biology, chemistry backgrounds that, you know, somehow pick up the tech skills because they're basically forced to in order to figure out, like, they can't do their jobs unless they solve these problems?
It's a very interesting persona. So every customer that I went to in my first 10 years of consulting when we were building up this practice, you would find a specific profile in research compared to the other value chain. You would be talking to IT that they would call research IT, but the folks there would have either been mostly a computational biologist, somebody who had done a molecular biology PhD, and then they picked up programming as a hobby, and then they moved to IT. So most of the profiles came from the business world, into picking up tech to actually solve a business problem, to your point, for them to learn that technology was easier than for an IT person to pick up the domain. Because just the number of constructs you had to learn, like what a ligand was, what a protein was, what an amino acid behind the protein, what does a protein folding mean, why is it important, was too much. So it was easy for, I think, the folks who were curious to pick up technology, and a lot of these applications, because of which was not really SDLC standard, if you were to put that in the software parlance. So you would have people who had picked up programming, created this wonderful app in, say, Python or Perl, and that would be running, but nobody else could do anything with it because they had written it and it was running, it was doing its job, but absolutely no idea of what was the secret sauce because there wouldn't be any documentation or release process. So most of our time was trying to re-engineering or taking it over for us to start scaling it up. We had to pretty much look into the code and like tweak things here and there, figure out what's breaking, and then try to create the artifacts. So that was most of the time in research. To your point, that's exactly the persona. Science guys who became techies.
Is that still the case today, or has it changed a little bit?
It's interesting. I think technology is more accessible now. So it's a bit more accessible than before. But if you look at some of these AI-based drug discovery companies, I haven't worked for one, but if you look at the profile, you still see folks with PhD in some either biophysics or a PhD in a certain business computational biology or domain. And they have always worked with technology all through their journey. So I still see that. But they would definitely have a team of engineers who can actually build the foundational models or algorithms that can now do these things. But the lead scientists would still need to understand, have that background and grounding in science, because there is no other way you can validate the output. Because whatever you do, you got to figure out if this algorithm works or not. It depends on how much you can interpret the outcomes, and that requires a science background. But I can say, because technology is more easy, it's not like you had to open a VI and write your code all the time now. I feel like a lot more technologists have the ability to learn up the domain and start tweaking with these things.
Yeah, from some of the companies that I've spoken to, you know, recently on interviews, it seems like they have their scientists for sure, but then they also have sort of traditional software engineering department that's, you know, people who've spent most of their career working on things that have nothing to do with essentially, you know, biotech.
I think if you're a company that's providing a product, like let's say if you are in the business of creating something like a Schrodinger, then you need that software engineering team, because you need to be able to sell a licensed commercial software that has documentation, training, and be able to reproduce it in any environment. So yes. But if you're in a pharma where you're not in the business of creating a software product, that's not your end goal, then I think you'll still see a research IT, or that's a mix of comp bio business who have actually picked up IT, because your end goal is to solve a specific problem, not necessarily create the software that's going to be sold to another company. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think like developing software to solve a specific problem in research is very different from building software that you're going to essentially give license to like
exactly.
A consumer.
Yeah. That's a commercial bread and butter. Yes. It has to be robust with grounded in engineering principles. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, most of the things I did during my time in research, I would be very embarrassed to give to anybody as like a consumer product.
But trust me, we have taken it over and it's fun. Some of them like to refactor, but it is not easy. Yeah, totally get it.
This episode of Software Engineering Daily is brought to you by Starburst. Struggling to deliver analytics at the speed your users want without your cost snowballing? For data engineers who battle to build and scale high-quality data pipelines, Starburst Data Lakehouse platform helps you deliver exceptional user experiences at petabyte scale without compromising on performance or cost. Trusted by the teams at Comcast, DoorDash, and MIT, Starburst delivers the adaptability and flexibility a Lakehouse ecosystem promises on an open architecture that supports Apache Iceberg, Delta Lake, and Hootie, so you always maintain ownership of your data. Want to see Starburst in action? Get started today with a free trial at starburst.io/SED.
So now with the cloud, you know, we have companies like Recursion and Benevolent AI, Menton AI, Big Hat Biosciences, I'm sure many, many others.
Accenture.
Yeah. I guess like how is cloud and AI like changing the landscape of drug discovery and other, you know, problems in the space that we were sort of talking about?
I don't think 6-7 years ago, there was a term that actually could exist. There was a pharma, then there was the small pharma or the biotechs, but I don't think there was an AI or AI-based drug discovery companies. That was a thing. But as you rattled off, there's like four or five big players who all have candidates in different stages in the clinical pipeline. Recursion, Accenture, Insilico, who have one in phase two, phase three, I think that's completely AI, where the target and the small molecule is designed by AI technologies. Benevolent. So that is a game changer in the sense that I was reading one of the interviews from Insilico like 4 years ago when he was asking for funds. I don't think he had a lot of VCs sign up for it because you didn't think that you could have AI generate a molecule that could actually be taken forward into something like in a regulatory setting like a trial. But that's the game changer. The fact that you can now accelerate, not just in the past when I said we were using machine learning or computational techniques to go down from millions of hits to 100,000s. Now you have the ability to design that one hit, which can actually be a successful candidate in clinical trial. So that de novo design is the game changer. Now you still need a human in the loop. You still need the humans to validate it. You still need to take it through a valid process of testing it in humans, testing it in animals. So it's not to say that you're going to create something that would be sent out immediately to authorities or get approvals for, but it still accelerated the pace and from where you can start with probably a design of a drug and take it forward to trial in 3, 4, 5, 6 years, which traditionally would take 15, 20. So being able to shrink that timeline is the biggest game changer. And that's why a lot of the big pharmas are also having the collaboration with these AI drug discovery companies, because any new candidate that gets into trials is a win-win for them to accelerate to commercial.
So where does the big pharma come into play? Are they partnering with these companies or, you know, buying their software? Like how does traditional pharma essentially interface with these different companies that are innovating, applying AI to speed up the timeline of drug discovery?
So there are AI techniques that a pharma can license to actually accelerate their own internal pipeline. So you will have the pharma are sitting, especially the big pharma, are sitting on tons of historical data, compound libraries. And one of the classic use cases, even 7 years ago, we were talking to in pharma before when cloud was just starting up, one of the first use cases we were talking was drug repurposing. You would have candidates and drugs that didn't work well on a certain target, but you are sitting on a wealth of information, but probably they could be repurposed for another indication or for another disease. And the way to do that is to do a simulation at scale on various different targets and use literatures to annotate and maximize the probability of success on past rejected candidates, right? So pharma can still leverage AI techniques to power through their pipeline. But given that there are companies whose bread and butter, that they have fine-tuned a model to the accuracy that they can actually hopefully predict with high degree of accuracy a compound that can bind to a target that can go to a trial, pharmas are looking at collaboration opportunities where if the candidate, say, goes after a certain milestone, the pharma could then take it over for further trials like phase three or launch. So it's more of the past where they used to work with a smaller biotech where they look at promising assets to take forward for clinical trials and thereafter. It's the same modality. You could get into a collaboration with one of these AI-based biotechs, and then the farther the pipeline goes, a pharma could then decide to take that molecule for late-stage trials and then commercial launches, which today the AI-based drug delivery is not their bread and butter. They are really looking to create the molecule that can have a bigger chance of success in trials, not necessarily go after launch and the regulatory paperwork after.
Can you share some details in how like people are actually leveraging generative AI across essentially the drug discovery pipeline?
Yeah, so quite a few of the techniques, like when we think of generative AI, the most common one that people think of is like summarization, right? Or in chatbot interfaces, right? You interact with your OpenAI, it writes a poem, it writes a blog, cool things that productivity accelerates our productivity in our day-to-day. In discovery, it's used for a lot of things that you wouldn't think of as possible. So one of the common challenges is the protein folding problem. So way back, the start of the drug discovery journey is you need to know which disease you're studying, and then there is a target, which is a protein that you want to go after. And then pretty much you're designing a small molecule that can either activate or inhibit that protein, which means that you're trying to connect this molecule to the protein like a lock and a key. And you need to exactly figure out the shape of the protein so you can figure out which of this compound would be actually able to connect to it or dock to it, as they call it, a docking study or a binding study. And in order to start do this thing, the first step is to figure out what is the shape of a protein and what is the structure. And most of the time, the thing was done in the lab by crystallography or X-ray techniques, beaming X-rays into it to see where it bounced off and then figuring out where the atoms were and drawing out the protein. It was a long manual process. The biggest breakthrough came when DeepMind by Facebook announced that they have used a generative AI technique to actually figure out from the amino acid sequence, which is a bunch of sequences that code for the protein, like how your DNA sequences code for a gene. They've been able to look at the sequence and then predict what the 3D structure might be. And that's one huge compelling value prop of generative AI in drug discovery, where you can feed a sequence in and you get a 3D output, taking months of effort into, you know, a few seconds or even minutes. So that was the biggest breakthrough. And they did that by similar techniques, right? You look at the patterns, you look at sequences, you look at the fold for that sequence. Over the years, there have been a lot of proteins that have been crystallized, and those are available in public data sources. So the algorithms can train on these patterns and then be able to predict a new sequence mimics similarly another sequence. So most likely the structure is going to be so and so. That's one compelling breakthrough for generative AI. The other one that's interesting is there is a stable diffusion model called DiffDock that I just was reading about. So similar to how traditionally you were doing docking between the protein and the small molecule using physics or biophysics on between whether there was enough, what is the optimal state of energy that would be necessary for these things to coexist. That was a physics problem, which was converted into an algorithm. Diffusion Dock pretty much uses, just like how you do DALI for image generation, they use a similar principle to see how docking, whether a protein and a small molecule can dock together. Again, it's looking at similar patterns based on patterns it has seen, but the idea is to accelerate with some high degree of accuracy and bring the ability, the successful candidates forward faster. So that's another promising area for drug discovery and generative AI. I think that's really cool. I've also seen like companies like Recursion use images of cells in robotics to actually accelerate how a molecule would perform inside a cell and use that to create successful candidates. I read up on interesting stuff, but for me, the biggest one is like protein folding and diffusion dock.
What is the training data for these different algorithms that they're developing? I mean, if they're using stable diffusion, presumably they must have a lot of image data that they're feeding in, and then they're applying essentially the diffusion technique to train on.
I agree. Actually, you got a hold of that because I haven't figured out what the training data for DiffDock is. But for the protein folding, it was definitely that we have a lot of folded proteins available on the website, like PDBs, CASPs. That was the training source for the alpha folds of the world. I actually haven't figured out what's the DiffDock's training data.
Is that a problem in the space? Is just getting enough like high value, high quality data to actually train these things on?
Yes. For example, not on the drug discovery, we were internally, as I said, part of the industry solutions that we were doing, trying to create a clinical trial protocol summarization. It's another use case that's more on the development, the D part of pharma than R. And the one thing that we found was, I mean, most of the customers we were talking to were asking for two kind of use cases in clinical, right? One is, can I try to create a new protocol, or can I create a clinical study report summary? The challenge we had was, if you wanted to create a solution to show our customers, it was easy to pick the protocol because it is available publicly with clinicaltrials.gov, but we don't have access to the clinical study report summarization as a training data set for us to do it. So then we are dependent on the customers to train it on their corpus. So yes, that is a challenge on how much of these models can work. But as I said, most of these companies whose business is to create AI fit for purpose models would be in a collaboration with a pharma who would have their corpus of data. So the collaboration is not just creating the model and moving it forward. It's actually being able to train it on, getting access to their data set to fine tune an existing foundational model and then take it forward. So that's how they would challenge it. Yeah.
Are they building all these things from scratch? Like they're building essentially their own foundation model. And if so, like how do they sort of balance the cost involved with doing all this stuff from a compute power?
It's a good question. I can't speak for the companies that their secret sauce is their AI-powered models. But most of the other companies that we talked to, like I was talking to another small medium biotech where we were looking to predict smile properties, the physiochemical properties of chemical compounds using smile string. And one of the foundational model they wanted to leverage is a variation of BERT called ChemBERTA. So a lot of these companies that are not in the business of doing AI-powered drug discovery are leveraging existing models in Hugging Face. They're people who have trained, for example, on PubMed extracts that are something like BioGPT that's available. So it's taking from that and then fine-tuning on your corpus works better for companies like pharma or small, medium biotech that's not in the business of creating the proprietary AI solution that you're selling commercially. So that's the route that we also have taken when we build industry solutions is look at existing models that has some kind of medical embedding or grounding in some biomedical text, and then we add layer on top of it with some additional data that we can get hold of, or we recommend to customers they do it on their data sets. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then we had talked earlier about how there's just so much data in the world of, you know, biosciences. And then without the advances that we've made in terms of, you know, cloud and advances that we're seeing in AI, do you think it would be essentially like impossible to make progress as like a biologist, as a computational biologist, without these advances? Because it's not like you can hold this stuff in your head. You need machines to help you actually do the hard science.
Yes. So a good example is, we didn't touch upon that because it's not really generative AI, but it's still compute powered, is medical image analysis. Mm-hmm. So today in a lab, one of the valid use cases is that a pathologist who's looking at a lot of cell images is trying to detect if there is a cancer, it's progressed to a certain stage, or has it metastasized, literally has to look at many, many different images of the same cell to see if they see any foreign particles or unusual substances that could have really potentially say help with identify a metastasis, right? That's a manual job. They have to hire, like, look at, say, 4,000, 5,000 images manually. But now the ability to do image recognition and deep learning of algorithms that are available, to your point, open source. NVIDIA has made available a bunch of open source libraries called MONAI for medical imaging. You could use that to look at some of these images and then predict potentially whether there is a specific classification of a nuclei cell type or not. And that helps accelerate the manual effort to something that's more manageable. Now, can that be used in diagnosis? For example, can I use a chest x-ray and feed it to a model and say, hey, this person has pneumonia or not? Can I use that to identify or diagnose and create a treatment pattern? I think not. You still need somebody to validate that it is true. But if you're looking to accelerate or highlight suspicious cases, I think AI becomes a very powerful tool for these biologists or pathologists to move forward faster. Otherwise, you're always going to be bottlenecked by the number of pathologists or radiologists you have available to do this kind of screening. So I think in that kind of situation where you're looking for a lot of throughput and that involves manual analysis, I think AI has definitely helped. In the drug discovery world with small molecules, I mean, as I said, computational technologies have been used forever. I couldn't have thought, like, humanly, it's impossible to go from a million to 100,000. Impossible. So that has always happened. What has now happened is, what cloud has really enabled you to do is, as I said, you don't have to walk up to the cluster anymore and wait for your grids to alert, the elasticity, the scale. Being able to now handle petabytes of data, people are now talking about cell painting. So you can also store image data of your brain cells and then process that. Just the volume and scale has increased beyond the fixed capacity that you would have been allowed to use. So I think that's the real value driver from a drug discovery perspective, besides the powering up of these AI companies. But to me, real value for the buck is in the hospitals or in the cancer centers, where you can now crunch through images much faster. That's mm-hmm. something that you can see even today.
Yeah.
You could also see the number of companies that are startups that have come up who actually do precision image analysis. That tells you how that's more real.
Yeah, even if you could automate some parts of like the diagnosis process for, you know, parts of the world where people don't necessarily have access to doctors, as there's doctor shortages or even specialist shortages, and not that you don't need those specialists or, you know, human in the loop to finally make the decision, but if you could do that with some level of accuracy, it could really change people's lives in terms of giving them access to the medical attention when they actually need it without sort of having to be limited by the number of doctors you can actually reach.
Totally. And I would think that in areas of the world where there's a lot of data connectivity, but they don't have access to a doctor, yes, you could potentially take a picture of a lesion or something, hopefully send that scan back and get back a recommendation. At least that warrants a follow-up visit or something that tells you, yes, you might want to go check with a care center. That I think is very powerful if you can get there. But yeah, it would not be a prescriptive diagnosis. It wouldn't be the one that says, yes, you need to get a treatment unless you have a human verify it for now.
Yeah. And what are some of the challenges that still need to be solved in the space of that, where we could be leveraging AI or compute to help solve?
I think hallucination, which everybody brings up when it comes with Gen AI. So in general, when we talk, when I was talking about to a traditional comp chem head, for example, of trying to see whether he would try DiffDoc or the diffusion model for docking instead of the traditional ones, which was more of the free energy perturbation, the physics-based one people are talking. The idea is that that's rock solid. It's been tested. It's been there for years. You know that you can predict, trust the outcome. With AI, can you not? We don't know, because the hallucination, your point, where was a model trained? How does it predict what it predicts? Can I have a traceability back to the source because of which it gave the prediction? I think that's not yet there. That's not yet pre-built. So then the fact is, okay, I got this new protein structure. I got this new compound. AI is telling me that these can dock, but is it reality? Is it something that's grounded in stone? Can I go and check if it's valid? it's still, sometimes it may not be because it's just pattern-based. It's not based on a grounded electrodynamics or, you know, thermodynamics, right? So that's where I think the challenge is for us getting into a robust way where you have some kind of traceability to control the hallucination or say that this outcome is based on all these things that you've seen. The other is being able to do it at scale for big pharma because it does require a lot of expertise. Fine-tuning is not easy. Everybody wants to do Gen AI, but, you know, when you go and tell them that, you know, in order to get a high precision, valuable, accurate outcome, you need to fine-tune on a corpus of data that's enormous and it requires a lot of sophisticated data science experts. So again, the skill would become an issue if you're going into that. So probably they're better off leveraging some of the companies that are doing it for a living. I think the third is for a technology provider like us, it's easy to show art of the possible. It's easy to show, hey, you can string together these compounds. These are the wonderful use cases you can solve. But to be able to tell a story, we need access to the data. And that's where I think we also struggle is we don't have access to a lot of public data for us to solve some of these cooler use cases. We pretty much have to show an art of the possible. Like, for example, in the smile string physiochemical prediction, we took a few data sets that were available from Kimball, but it would be more accurate if we had access to an actual data set. So we then have to hand it back to the customer and make sure that they can move forward themselves. So access to quality data is also another challenge for us. And the last is, as I said, in the impact where as long as you're using it to accelerate your research, but you're still validating it at a regulatory setting, it's fine. But if you're really looking for it to be to your point of care delivery, diagnosis, I think that requires some time and investment and a lot of hand-holding and experts labeling the ground truth better to be able to get to that high degree of accuracy. That requires a community effort. So then the question is, what is the community that gets behind shaping these models? And that's TBD to me at this point here. Because you can't have one company create this great model and then it's very expensive for everybody to use. You're going to get into a black box situation.
Is validation or testing also a big problem? Like, how do you know essentially that you're making the model better as you do more fine tuning and you do more like iterations on the model?
It's a feedback loop. So that's where the human in the loop, to your point, was talking about. There are experts, for example, folks who built these protocol authorization kind of algorithms would have a doctor or somebody who verifies the actual authored content to make sure that this is of good quality versus it's not. And that human in the loop providing feedback to fine tuning is what improves the model quality. And that's why I said it's not easy. So if you were a pharma and that was what you're going to do, it requires experts from both sides, technology to fine tune, but also the experts who knows the outcome to say, yes, this is right or this is not, and take the feedback to get a more accurate model. And then you track the accuracy over time, which is why grounding it in the source is important. Say, for example, you authored a new protocol for a specific phase 3 study, and it suggested that one based on something it has seen for a related study that was phase 3 with another small change in exclusion criteria, for example. If you were able to link that back to the source, it's more easy to validate and say, hey, yeah, this looks kind of correct and I could tweak it. But connecting it back to where you got the information from, being able to create the traceability would also help with the feedback and validation. I think that's still TBD. Again, for the companies that are doing it for bread and butter, like, I don't know how they track the quality, how they measure the outcome, but they do have humans in the loop, but I don't know how they keep track of the model drift and accuracy over time.
Yeah. Okay. And then how does Snowflake just sort of fit into this world? Like, how is Snowflake facilitating the integration of AI and machine learning algorithms into life sciences workflows, and particularly maybe in the world of drug discovery?
Yeah, totally. And this is my two cents of being a practitioner and leveraging Snowflake as a technology. So there was an announcement that came recently called Container Services. So that allowed a lot of possibility. Basically, you could containerize and create a Docker of any particular algorithm and bring it into Snowflake. So all the Gen AI components I talked about was made possible because of this announcement, because we could now bring an open source model from Hugging Face like Llama 2 and fine tune it and create an app in front of it and let customers use it. So one of the gaps we had, or not gaps, is the persona we didn't address to in the past was pure data science or early research, where, as I told you, you didn't need, they were not SQL users. The data was not tabular. So we needed to tackle a couple of things. One is, how do I handle these semi-structured or unstructured data, like a FASTA file, like amino acid sequences, or like a smile string or an image? How do I tackle that? And the second one is, what can I run to find predictions, right? I didn't want to write SQL-based Python programming. Can I run native Python? Can I run R? Can I run stuff in a notebook? And can I create the inferences via an app, like a React.js framework, not like a Power BI? So what has happened with container services? The answer is it's possible. You could now Dockerize an R and run it within Snowflake. You could now have PyTorch models that process images be deployed on the container so that we can process the images. The images can remain in a cloud store and it can do the inference real time on Snowflake. You can capture, we have a partnership where we wrote with in conjunction with NVIDIA on protein folding. We didn't host the model because of the GPU needed, but NVIDIA hosted it, but we were able to send an amino acid sequence, get the PDB file back, manage the PDB within Snowflake and render it inside an app within Snowflake. So the possibility of talking to this modality of data science persona and users who need tools besides SQL, that is where Snowflake is now talking and taking the journey with the R&D forward. We also are building a lot of partnerships on that angle. So some of it, it's not just our story. It's about being able to bring the data in. There is no AI without data. So it's how soon can we get the lab data into Snowflake? So we're also looking at targeted partnerships to connect to instrument vendors and they can pipe the data in so that we can do some of the prediction and predictive analytics better and faster. So that's another thing. But all of this happened with our ability to support multiple kind of modalities with containers. There are also some native LLM features being available like vector databases, semantic search. But if you're looking for very domain differentiated models, the idea would be to fine tune it yourself or work with a partner company that is creating an LLM that can run on Snowflake, which is another modality that we're also talking to. Yeah.
Yeah, even the native like Python support in Snowflake's gotten significantly better over the last couple of years, which is probably makes a big difference if you're working in the life sciences space, because it sounds like they've kind of gone from Perl to Python as their, you know, language of choice.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if Perl is still used. I mean, I haven't coded in Python. It was all Perl back then. And it's R is still around. So yeah, if you without Python, R, I think it's a very tough sell to talk to anybody in R&D. And then you have some, you'd be surprised there are still some C++ machine learning algorithms that are running. So being able to wrap all that into a compute, into a managed container is where I think the value prop is for Snowflake. Yeah. And there are partners who are also willing to wrap that and run that on our container. So we don't have to do it. Customer doesn't have to do it. You could also choose the partner who has done it to run it on us.
Yeah, the first machine learning algorithms I ever wrote were in C++, but I'm very glad to have moved on from then.
So. But that's the interesting part of research is you're always surprised. It's no standard set of reporting. It's no standard set of tools. Everybody has their favorite language. And then, voila, there is an algorithm that's been running and does its thing well for years.
You recently wrote a blog post about Snowflake and drug discovery. Can you talk me through what you were trying to show in that article?
Yeah, sure. As I said, that was the one I referred to, which was in partnership with NVIDIA. So NVIDIA, besides our GPU chips that they sell, also have foundational models like BioNeMo that is focused towards drug discovery. So the idea was, can we just call the model hosted outside and then show you how you can manage the data within Snowflake? Because one of the questions we get asked is, why Snowflake, right? And the power is not specifically to solve a very niche vertical solution. It's not like, if I only want to do image analysis, that's not the point. The point is, how can I use this data in conjunction with other data? Like, how can I connect a clinical phenotype data back to something that's an omics? So stuff like that. So the idea here is, we wanted to show an art of possible where the sequence is FASTA that has the amino acid that's managed in a Snowflake stage, where we input that into a Jupyter notebook, call the folding function hosted by NVIDIA, get the file back, which is again a flat file, which is the PDB with the coordinates of the protein. And then we created a Streamlit app. Streamlit is an acquisition we made that is a Python library, which is a front-end interactive app. So we fed that PDB to a Streamlit, which can understand the PDB because of the BioPython library called PyMol, Py3DMol. And then you can actually see how the protein looks by the rendering. And the idea is that, imagine you are a company that has a lot of assets, as I said, and you're creating a findability use case. You now have an ability to store the metadata of the protein inside Snowflake, including how the structure information, and connect that if you want with the compound that docks to it. So you can now actually progressively link from your biology to chemistry, because we also have support for structure search via RDKit, another Python library. So you could now do target analysis, compound analysis, and then string together that to later preclinical. So it's a way of managing all of the R&D data within Snowflake. That was the pattern here.
And then you mentioned earlier that there's some partnerships that Snowflake is working on to bring more sort of data specific to like the bio life sciences into Snowflake. But are there other, you know, product investments that Snowflake is making to kind of help in this area to make it easier to essentially answer that question of why Snowflake to solve these particular problems?
I can speak again on the industry side. The partnership angle is what we've been leveraging. because we're not building a vertical solution. It's more of a technology company. And then the idea is that then we leverage companies that are doing a fit for purpose solution well, or an SI who's building that connectivity or accelerator well, to make it work better with Snowflake. But Snowflake itself has certain features that we are leveraging. For example, they announced a set of capabilities called Cortex AI that, instead of managing in the container service world, you manage the, it's bring your own model. You manage your PyTorch model, or you manage your GenAI model. In the Cortex AI, it's managed by Snowflake. So it lets you use some of the summarization, sentiment analysis, vector data types out of the box. So your variation of the use case that I was talking about is, say, for example, you want a RAG pattern, you don't want complete fine-tuning. One of the things we want to try out is, can I convert each smile string into a chemical embedding, store it inside the native vector data type of Snowflake, and then do a similarity search to find similar compounds, instead of the traditional way is, you know, run RDKit or do an index mechanism. That's what we call cartridges. So those are some of the technology capabilities that can be repurposed for life science. And that's what, again, we are looking to build some industry point of views and solutions to illustrate that. The other is create some medical embeddings, like in the protocol use case, create medical embeddings of the terms we see in clinical protocols, and then let customers find similar protocols by similarity search. Say, phase 3 HER2 positive breast cancer, do I have any information? As long as the embedding is there in your vector database managed by us, you can find all the hit results that are similar. So again, accelerate search. So that would be some of the art of possible solutions, leveraging native capabilities. Mm-hmm. But for specific inferencing solutions, we would leverage on our partners or existing foundational models like Monai that we can repurpose and give it to customers. Yeah.
That makes sense. And then outside of Snowflake, you know, from your perspective, what are some of the emerging trends that you foresee at the intersection of cloud technology and AI that you're particularly excited about?
For me, I think I'd love to see what happens in the drug value chain to see if the first AI-based candidate makes it further along. So that would be exciting. The second thing that's interesting for me is looking at companies that are actually in the process of creating wearables, patient engagement better, to your point of healthcare at point, access, right? There are pharma companies that are trying to engage with patients much more closer with digital apps, right? So they are looking for information coming back from patients, and they want to be able to understand how, one of the biggest fears for pharma is when patients drop off, like when they stop being on a certain drug. So real-time exchange using mobile is something that is being looked at, and see when does a patient go off a certain first-line therapy. Is it because they find it too difficult to use, or is it because they're not monitoring their body mesh as well? So is that something that they can push more information on, things like that. And the most recent one that I think was exciting was being able to look at probes inside your cell and see how a molecule moves inside, or how a particular drug doesn't hit the target. And that requires a lot of image capture, and that requires a lot of image data to be analyzed. I'm curious to see how cloud technology scale up to be able to do that at scale, to come up with an inference, because one of the biggest challenges for drugs not working is you don't know why it doesn't hit the target, why it doesn't bind, what happens once it's inside a specific cell. It's very difficult to trace it. So cell imaging, high content screening going to help there. I'd love to see what's happening. There are companies that are actually doing it as a product as well. Yeah, some of those things.
How would they send that information back to the cloud? Like, is it some sort of wearable that the person is using? Like, how do they actually monitor the interaction with the cell?
That's a good question. There's a probe. My understanding is that one of the customers we talked to was having a probe which tracks how the particular encoded protein moves inside. And then they can actually get snapshots of that movement via, just like your heart monitor. That is, you have today in devices that are plugged to your pacemaker that actually streams data, talks to your data to get results, and then it can actually come back to you with a prediction of some, there is an arrhythmia or something that's not regular. So similar to that, the probe would actually stream the data back, and potentially that's the image that you're capturing. Now, I don't know how technologically its streaming works and what is the modality behind, but that's pretty much to me how cell painting was described. So that's interesting. I haven't seen that demo myself in real time. I've seen images of it.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. That's really taking the heart monitor idea to the next level.
Yeah, next level of, yeah, because it's not data, it's more images, yeah.
Yeah, amazing. And then as we start to wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to share?
I think the exciting thing now is like looking at the promise of how some of the companies are successful in tackling this at more real-time outcomes. So as I said, everything that we talked about is exploratory. I'd love to see how that scales up to something more real. I know that I was told that there was a vaccine. Now, people can design faster vaccines because you can create variations of an effective vaccine, like in COVID. They can look at the, as things mutate, you can create effective variants faster and launch that easily in the market. Again, more exploratory use cases. Love to see how that works. So yeah, thanks for having me too. And I know you're talking to a lot of cool companies, John. So you'll probably let me know how things are panning out with them.
Yeah, you'll have to listen in. Well, Harini, thank you so much for being here. This was really, really fascinating. I think you gave a really good background in terms of a lot of stuff that's going on in the space. It sounds like this is really, you know, the age of biology in a lot of ways. Like a lot of this stuff is emerging, areas that are probably going to have significant impact in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years moving into the future for the century.
Yeah, sure. And every use case that's interesting happens to be in life science also because of the fact that there's so much possibilities, as you said, in biology, chemistry, imaging. So yeah, I'm sure in 5 to 10 years, there's going to be a lot more breakthrough.
All right. Well, I'm glad we're leaving on a positive note. But anyway, thank you so much and cheers.
Thanks, Sean. And yeah, we'll be in touch and you'll keep me posted as well. I'll watch your rest of the cool videos.
All right. Thanks.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.